Intervju Radija Študent.
Torej, pozdravljeni v današnjem terminu za Ereš intervju. Z nami so člani zasedbe Borbeto Magos, ki danes večer nastopijo v kinu Šiški skupaj z nizozemskim saksofonistom Tomasom Ankersmitom. So hello guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So maybe my first question for Borbeto Magos. You have been around for many years and those people that know you speak of you as like superstars, but you are still quite unknown among the wider audience. So is that due to good or bad self-promotion? You know, is it good self-promotion because you want to stay off the top charts, or bad self-promotion because you would like to be on top charts but you don't enter?
Well, my guess is that after tonight, all of this will change.
Uh-huh. How is that?
Well, because we're here.
Uh-huh. So you're going to be better known.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Everything will change after tonight.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Apparently your music in the past was quite difficult to understand even for those more radical listeners. But maybe in the past 10 years things have changed a bit because this noise improv music picked up a bit. Is that so for Borbeto Magos as well?
I think so. I think we basically just kind of from the very beginning in 1979 when we first started playing just set out to make music that pleased us and that challenged listeners, and we've continued to do that, and if audiences have kind of caught up with us, we're happier for that.
Mm-hmm. But have you changed this that you maybe increased popularity in the past 10 years because of all these new bands?
No.
No, it's the same.
No, we're still doing exactly the same thing. We're just somehow more people have eventually, slowly but surely, heard of us, and we've maybe that way have had a little bit more influence on a few influential noise people. But otherwise, it's we're still doing exactly the same thing. No mm-hmm. compromise.
Mm-hmm. Tomas, you found your position inside this younger improvised scene. So do you maybe know how Borbeto Magos is received within this scene?
No.
Well, that's an honest answer.
That's honest.
No, I mean, I sort of strange.
What is the scene,
I know some people are very aware of them and realize that they were really sort of pioneers in certain things, and then there's also people who work in sort of my field who have never heard of them or who sort of know of them but have never. I mean, of course, they're in the U.S. and they don't tour in Europe that much, and they also don't tour in the U.S. much. So mm-hmm. It's somehow still possible to.
Mm-hmm. And what caught your attention when you first heard them?
That's a good question. I think the first exposure to the band may actually have been an interview in Banana Fish, this noise underground music magazine that I think doesn't exist anymore, but it was a very kind of influential magazine in hardcore underground avant-garde music in the 90s in particular, I think. And this is when I was sort of in my late teens, and I was just looking around for, I acquired a taste for unusual and kind of abrasive music. And for some reason or another, I immediately liked Barbido Magus very much, and they became a big inspiration to also, you know, start playing saxophone. And
And how did you come up with this interview for the magazine?
I didn't do the interview. I read the interview. I found the magazine in some underground rock record store, I think, in Amsterdam, and I read it from cover to cover, and I'll probably try to find the records of a number of people who were in the magazine, which was, you know, back in the mid-90s was harder than it would be now. You know, having to order records into a local record store in my hometown, which is not, you know, a major city. And
So you are one of the bands that maybe changed or helped change the perception on music and sound itself. Do you feel like that is the case, or?
we may have inspired people to make music. We may have shown people that you can make music that's challenging without compromising. We may have encouraged people to think of saxophones in a different way, and certainly a combination of saxophones and guitar, because some people have come up to me and say, you know, I used to play saxophone, and you've renewed my interest in the instrument. So I think we've pushed the limits of our instruments. We've pushed the sound of the group over the years. And I think that as we've done that as sort of a natural evolution as a group, I think perhaps there has been more of an appetite or more of a tolerance for music that is pushing the limits. So I think in some ways, you know, we have maybe inspired some people, or we've given them license to explore that themselves, or
I guess
encouragement.
Any band, any group that works in a very uncompromising and rather unique way for 30 years must have an impact on younger people with similar interests and just a wider audience. I mean, even though it's not hundreds of thousands of people, it may very well be a few thousand.
Well, let me bring up an often told story, but pardon me, I have a cold. I believe it was 1981. We received a letter from this strange person in Japan.
I receive high impact with Barbido Magus.
Yes,
from Barbido Magus.
A critique on our first album, signed Masami Akita, Mertzbau. Cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, that there's the direct answer to your question. I mean, he heard the record that you have out there. And he received high impact from Barbido Magus. And that was, you know, noise music's number one guy, Masami.
Well, I think what we found is that there were individuals like him who we hadn't met or known at that time that were seeking out, much like Thomas, was looking for music that sounded like the kind of thing that he would be excited by. And in that note, he also mentioned he was attracted to the cover and the unusual instrumentation, and probably just on a gamble of the way the record looked, bought the record. And then he wanted to know more about the group. And Thomas had... But so I think, you know, if you were looking for challenging music, you had to put a little effort in. Before the internet made it so easy, you had to seek it out. And that was part of the fun. You know, that was part of the challenge, was trying to find those rare albums, or to hear about or learn about groups that, you know, were doing things that would be exciting.
One way of pushing your music was through collaborating with other artists, and you encountered John Zorn, among many others. Is that so? Or
no? That's
very
a
rarely, if
no.
ever.
No, we have absolutely.
I read that you had a really bad experience with him, or.
When I was in New York City, Don and Jim lived outside, and before I met them in 1979, I was trying to become a playing musician out in the very, very, very small scene, quote unquote, in New York at the time, and John Zorn and Eugene Chadbourne were the sort of the major domos, as they'd established themselves, of that particular domain. And I did approach them. I did attempt to work with them. I tried to work around them, and they also made it very clear that they thought that I was absolutely nuts in what I was trying to do and to go away, which probably was the biggest favor they could have done for me. Because it did sort of isolate me. It had me, concentrate on a particular form of guitar playing that I was, that I wanted to follow. I was working in this one particular band, but they wanted to go into a more rock direction, and I wanted to go into more new music direction. I finally met these guys, Don and Jim. And we got together and played, and it was, history, really.
Mm-hmm. But after that, you worked with Thurston Moore, or is that?
I have never worked with Thurston.
We've done some double bills. Uh-huh. We did one anyway.
Don and Jim did an album where it was the guys at Forced Exposure thought it would be fun to replace me with Thurston for an album, and so they did Barefoot in the Head, which was also very good exposure for the band. The guys in Sonic Youth were fans and have done a lot to, tell people about, mention their name and over the years. One phenomenon, just to sort of address something you had mentioned before about whether we've reached people or not, there was a generation of younger listeners who had heard about us. And for some reason or other, had never actually heard us, but had always heard that we were, this absolutely amazing, legendary, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And for example, when I left New York City and moved to New Orleans in 2001, I encountered this, I was known amongst all these college students at Tulane University and Loyola, like, but they never. We were the most famous band that nobody had ever heard or actually sought out and listened to, which got to be a little bit aggravating. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we're getting a little bit better heard now with YouTube and all that nonsense. But
So Thomas, you seem to, with your music, to be on the other end with your subtleness, and it's a bit more quiet music. I mean, quite more quiet compared to Burbeto Magos. So what do you think you have in common with Burbeto Magos?
Well, may not even be the most relevant question. I mean, for me, they were an inspiration that led me to where, 15 years after hearing them for the first time, I now do something that's not necessarily comparable to what they do. But I do, I mean, for me, for example, the using the saxophone as more of a kind of generator of complex sound that's not necessarily related to jazz music at all is a big thing for me. And just the kind of general, this kind of balance between chaos and control, or kind of brutality and fragile detail. I mean, they're more brutal and I'm maybe more fragile or whatever, but I do kind of see, I mean, the reason that I like Burbeto Magos, that I always did, is not just the loudness of it, but also the kind of, if you listen closely or if you sort of zoom in, there's a lot of detail there and a lot of sort of intelligence behind the first, impact, as Mertzbau would say. So I do think of different forms of electroacoustic music, noise music, different approaches as sort of different sides of the same coin or something. Of, you can do You can make a noise can be very loud, or a noise can actually be very quiet, and it can still have sort of similar qualities.
Mm-hmm. As far as music in live contests go, do you have your stuff prearranged, or does it happen on spot?
It's both. On this tour, I've mostly been playing sort of compositions, which are largely I know where it's going to go, and a lot of the patches on the synthesizer, for example, are I have a good idea of what they're going to do. And if I work with other people, it tends to be more open and more of an improvisation.
Mm-hmm. And you guys, you always improvise. You don't have...
No, we're working on the same composition.
We're working on the same... It's a work in progress for 32 years.
It's the same piece. We're just trying to perfect it and improve upon it.
A lot of sandpaper.
We have a couple of sort of catchphrases that are... also based on some, you know, in jokes of having worked together and toured over 30 some years, that we might say, well, let's do, and it's a sort of a routine type of thing, but it is how one say always improvised.
Mm-hmm.
But we may approach it from a way that we've done before and that we liked, and mm-hmm. hope that it works as well as it did has in the past, but it will sound completely different.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Musamia Kita Murzbo earlier, and it seems that you were quite an inspiration for many younger Japanese, especially Japanese artists. And you know, when you were starting, they already had this tradition that Masayuki Takayanagi and Kaoru Abe put up. So did you know maybe their music when you were starting?
I didn't.
Just a little bit, because there was one... There was that one album that my Dutch sculptor friend in New York with an amazing record collection gave to me, which was that had one of their quartets I think it was the two, it was Nakamura and a cellist and two drummers.
Mm-hmm, I don't know. And
it was a live cut from a festival on Japanese BYG or some label. I was playing it on the radio, and you actually pulled over to the side of the road to turn it up. That's what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but that was only like one small thing of like, wow, this is kind of close to what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
This is really very good.
Well, I think that what we found when we did eventually have the opportunity to perform in Japan was that there was this appetite and this culture of loud, noisy stuff, and we were playing on bills in Tokyo, for instance, with Meyersbau and the Incapacitants, and then Borbido Magus, three groups in one night,
mm-hmm.
and it was unbelievably loud. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't even be in, I could barely be in the room for a short period of time for these other groups.
I saw Meyersbau maybe a couple years ago, he did a really loud show.
Yeah,
you really get the physical sense of the sound.
Well, you do, but it wasn't that interesting either. So it was like I kind of had to just get out of there and try and keep my head a little bit clear. But this audience was a packed house, and people sat there from beginning to end through those three groups. I mean, and they were there for us, I assume, but they weren't going to give up their seat until we were.
Yeah, you're addressing probably people from the actual old free jazz scene in Japan. Our impact seems to have been, not to overuse that term in reference of Japanese musicians, but our impact does seem to have been within the noise community.
Although, and must be noted, footnote to that statement, which is that we are the only American band certainly the only American band up to a point to ever appear on the Japanese PSF record label.
That's not true.
We were.
Yeah, we were for a long time, but
then we were the first. We broke a long-term tradition.
Mm-hmm. Thomas, you have experience with Japanese musicians as well, and probably with playing in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you think that this the more extreme side of music is so well received there? Did you ever ask yourself about that? Is it just about the tradition?
Not really. I mean, I would just be wildly speculating. I mean, I...
Ask someone from that particular scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ask Gornet.
I mean, Japanese society seems very homogenous to me and sort of constricting. But other than that, I mean, in the sense that if you... my impression was always that if you belong to a kind of subculture, you do something that's not mainstream corporate culture in Japan, you very quickly become a kind of outsider, and you're very apparent as an outsider. Even if you, if I would be on the subway with a Japanese friend, for example, it's guy Toshimaru Nakamura, who plays feedback basically in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
That even him, and he strikes me as a very normal guy, but if him and I are on the subway together, we really look like, we really feel like outsiders. I mean, maybe that kind of mm-hmm. homogenous society leads to people seeking very extreme forms of
mm-hmm.
entertainment or art, but... and I mean, I know a lot of Japanese musicians who, you know, don't necessarily work in those extremes of volume or...
Yeah, definitely. There are plenty. So what was your entering point to improvisation when you started?
Mine?
Mm-hmm.
I basically just started... I guess the first thing is that when I was about 16 years old, I ended up getting a secondhand electric guitar, like, you know, like all teenage boys do. And my dad actually showed me how to make guitar feedback on this guitar amp that he had built himself when he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately made me lose my interest in learning how to normally play the guitar, because I guess that was my idea when I bought the thing. And then, so I discovered noise music, electroacoustic music, improvisation through punk and post-punk and underground rock in Holland in the mid-90s. And I got bored with that very quickly, and I became interested in all these more experimental forms very quickly. And then finding the saxophone a few years later as an accident, basically in a secondhand store in New York, was sort of the first time that I felt that maybe I could actually do something in public, because before that I'd simply been literally just like messing around by myself at home
mm-hmm.
with this guitar and electronic junk that I'd literally found on the street and things like that, and that was all very, you know, they were the baby steps.
Mm-hmm. And Burbeto Magos, when you were starting, you were mostly informed by the American music, the legacy of jazz music.
Burbeto Magos can't answer that question as one single unit. We're three Burbeto Maglets. And so, you know, each of us have our own source of inspiration. You know, I think Jim and I, growing up in a fairly isolated, conservative environment, we live very close to each other, and there wasn't much that we could have access to. I mean, you know, Mothers of Invention, Captain Beefheart, Hendrix, of course, Cream, you know, Johnny Winter, Electric Mud, blah, 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 blah. I mean, so by and large, and this is as we were teenagers, of course. This was our roots of sorts. But we're also sponges when it comes to, you know, new things. It's always been a challenge to find music, different music, add new things to our vocabularies and such. And so, you know, when we hooked up with Donald in 79, his record collection was, you know, immediately coveted by us, and we wanted the same sorts of things that he had. And we quickly absorbed these outside influences, largely European, into our playing at that point. So it's a combination of early on very much American blues, rock, jazz, and then quickly flipping and adding some European classical, modern classical, as well as European free improvisation and so forth. Mm-hmm. That's I think that probably sums up Jim and my situation.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you had the idea how your music should sound, but what was the thing that attracted you to music as opposed to some other artistic language?
Well, I think the immediacy when you're playing music of sort of reaching sort of a musical cohesion when you're playing live, and also the immediacy of playing for an audience live is a very exciting experience, I think. Mm-hmm.
But we're also involved in a number of other art forms. Jim is involved with design and does some very interesting things for himself in that nature. Don is an established sculptor. I'm a painter. Don and I are both products of art school, and I also write. So we all have evolved careers in the visual arts as well.
So maybe just a couple more questions because we're running out of time slowly. You mentioned audience earlier. The reaction of the audience is quite important for you. So probably the live context of Barbeto Magos is more important than the studio one. Most of the records are live recordings.
I would say that's true. Yeah, I mean we like working with in a live context because in a way a lot of what we do making the music is to sort of create something unique within a given room in a given space at a given time with a given audience. Mm-hmm. And that audience, it doesn't matter necessarily about the number of people in that audience as much as the people that are there and with us.
Yeah, usually some kind of circumstance comes up that someone requests or someone gives us money to make a studio recording. But for the most part, we just go out, we play live as often as possible, and sometimes we have terrific recordings and they get released. Mm-hmm. So that's largely circumstantial that we have that live impact, and we also have the many live recordings.
I would say also because we had a shortage of good recordings that we recently went into the studio, and we have a studio album coming out in the beginning of next year, which is double bass saxophones and guitar. It's using our Bells Together technique. Mm-hmm. So it'll be one of the first studio releases on our own Agaric label in some time. And that will be coming out early next year.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So maybe one more question for Thomas. What aspect do you concentrate on when you play live? What's the most important aspect?
I guess the most important aspect is to kind of keep tension and focus and kind of keep it up there, mm-hmm. and to just have this kind of energy flow of events. And for me, timing is very important. I think in all music, timing is very, very important, but just this sense of tension and kind of balance between maybe turbulence and kind of rest and back to turbulence or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Unfortunately we ran out of time. Thank you guys for coming to studio.
Well, it's
maybe
a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Want to invite the audience to come tonight or
please do.
Okay. Thank you very much. To je bil torej intervju z osebo Barbeto Magos in Tomasom Ankersmitom, ki danes večer ob 21. lahko vidite v kinu Šiška. Z njimi sem se pogovarjal Goran. Lep pozdrav.
Intervju Radija Študent.